The Arthropod. The Arthropod is the home for the wonderful, weird, wacky world of insects. Hosted by Jonathan Larson, Jody Green, and Michael Scavarla.
Five, four, three, two. Welcome back, everybody, to Arthropod, your entomology podcast. I am one of your hosts for the day, Jonathan Larson of the University of Kentucky.
I'm another one of your hosts, Jody Green from the University of Nebraska-Lincoln.
And I'm your last host today, Michael Scavarla with
his
Penn
NPR
State.
Voice coming at us. Learned that when you were a media superstar for 15 minutes, right?
I was. We have a whole episode about it, actually.
People should check it out. Are you glad that it's over? Does it feel weird to have been talked about on Jimmy Fallon?
Yeah, it feels weird. But I'm also glad that it's over because that's all I did for a week. I did like 14 interviews and it was exhausting. And now I'm glad to be back to my real life.
Now you have 51 other weeks to take care of with normal everyday extension stuff.
Yep.
I actually mentioned that during my Master Gardener talk because we were talking about, I don't know what, but talked about you. And then after, one of the questions when they were lined up to talk to me was, what did they do with the giant lacewing? So I was like, did you not read the thing?
So we had that episode. We also had an interview with Aaron Bauer, our other most recent episode. You can learn about getting your online degree in entomology if you want to check that out. I'm excited about today's show, though. It's going to be kind of a weird one. We are going to be talking about one singular insect. And I'm going to try and talk about it from like point A to point Z and everything in between. Are you guys excited to talk about the Colorado potato beetle?
I am.
Yes.
So excited.
Can I ask why you chose such a topic?
Okay. That's an excellent question because I myself was asking myself that when I was writing this whole thing was, why am I doing this? And if I was going to be 100% honest with you, this is an insect that sort of, you know, that Bader-Meinhof phenomenon where like you see something and then you can't stop seeing the thing everywhere that you turn, that sort of sensation. Like I collected a Colorado potato beetle when I was a kid. It was a part of my 4-H collection. I remember it distinctly. I remember identifying it because it was a cool looking beetle, but I never really thought about them ever since. Like it's not my favorite insect or anything, but I had to read about them quite a bit when we did the DDT episodes, and following that, it just seemed like everything that I did and everything that I wrote and everything that I filmed, somehow Colorado potato beetles were like seeping into it, especially when I was teaching my IPM class. And the more I learned about it, the more I came to realize that this is history's favorite beetle. Like this is history's favorite beetle of all time. It pops up at all these different points in history that are kind of pivotal in the course of entomology. And it's behaved in so many weird ways. I just kind of wanted to see if I could sit down and tell its story. It's also a very published insect. Like there's lots of papers on it. And there's even a book out that was all about potato pest with two or three chapters just about the Colorado potato beetle. So I wanted to try and put all of this together and make a podcast about it. I can feel your hesitation. I'm curious about what your experiences are with Colorado potato beetle, though.
I don't think I've ever seen one in my job here in Nebraska. I feel like I've seen one in Indiana.
Okay. So you moved from Canada and saw one?
No, I probably saw one when I was in grad school. But I do work with master gardeners and some of the teaching gardens, and we have potatoes growing there. And I have not seen Colorado potato beetle. However, when I was talking to my sister last night, and we did talk about spongy moth, we started talking about the Colorado potato beetle. And she volunteers at a place called The Farm in Ottawa, Ontario, Canada. And she has dealt with these as a farm. So I was like, whoa.
It's definitely made us
all about it. Yeah.
To Canada. That doesn't surprise me. I am very intrigued that you are saying you don't necessarily see them on your potatoes in the Master Gardener farm, because one of the other reasons I wanted to talk about this is specifically for Mike, there's a lot of war stuff that pops up with this.
I was surprised when you said, I don't know why I'm actually writing this. So it's like, I would have assumed that that was the entire reason behind all of it.
Well, there's one very specific war piece that I think will be something that you can sink your teeth into. It's more modern, but the more like distant past part of it involves a lot of Nebraska. That was the other reason I wanted to talk about this, is because you can bring that Nebraskan perspective.
Well, thank you for thinking of me.
Mike, what is your experience with Colorado potato beetle?
I guess not much. Like, I obviously know what they are and that they're pests of solanaceous crops. I don't hardly get them in the ID lab. What I do get actually more than Colorado potato beetle are false Colorado potato beetles.
Yeah.
I've gotten probably 5 or 6 of those in one Colorado potato beetle. And I don't know why I'm getting more of them. Are you going to talk about false Colorado potato beetles at all?
I didn't put it in there because they're a pretender to the throne and I don't appreciate them.
Okay.
I mean, we can throw them out there a couple of times, but.
Oh, we don't have to. Just for listeners, there's another species that's very similar. False Colorado potato beetles have a brown stripe down the elytra. Colorado potato beetles don't.
Yep.
And they feed on horse nettle instead of potatoes. And that's about it. Like, that's the difference.
It is something that obviously gets confused with this pest a lot. So it's an important one. I think I've had maybe one sample of this in my career, and I've only ever been requested to speak on it one time. I spoke last year to like a big consortium of the farmers market growers here in Kentucky, and they specifically said they wanted to hear about Colorado potato beetle. So I presume that we get little outbreaks of it. In my research for this, I found out that the University of Kentucky fact sheet is one of the main sources on Wikipedia about Colorado potato beetle. So we must have a pretty good fact sheet compared to some others. But I professionally, not a lot of connection here. It's an eminently interesting insect because of some of these different things where it pops up.
I guess professionally, yes, I don't encounter it. I don't grow potatoes at my house because of them.
Uh-huh.
So on the back part of my property, I have a really big patch of bittersweet nightshade that I've been trying to eradicate. And it's another solanaceous plant, and it is covered in Colorado potato beetles. And to the point that I can't grow potatoes nearby because so many come off of this bittersweet nightshade. And I've been ripping it out by the armloads for years, and I cannot get this patch under control. It is outrageous.
Have you been nightshade poisoned?
No, by touching them?
I don't know.
No, but it's stinky and gross, and I hate this plant so much. But I can't. They support Colorado potato beetle, so I can't grow potatoes.
They sure do. That's actually. I put in a little bit of management stuff at the end, and one of the big IPM strategies for it is to make sure that you get rid of all alternative hosts that are in the area.
That makes sense.
Nightshade and ground cherry.
It's so hard. They're so frustrating.
So you don't deal with it at work, but you deal with it at home.
That's true. Yeah. Yep. I'm surprised. What's that?
I was just going to say the bug of life. But
surprised I don't deal with it at work because we've got a big, surprisingly, potato production in Pennsylvania. We actually are the biggest producer of like potato flakes, which is the kind of dried processed potatoes that go into things like pierogies or box mashed potatoes.
Okay.
So we have a really big potato production in Pennsylvania. Wow, that's a lot of peas.
It is a lot of peas.
But I've never had growers reach out about them. So that's weird now that I'm thinking about it.
That makes sense with pierogies, I guess, right?
The potatoes?
Aren't you guys huge onto pierogies?
Oh, yeah. Yep. Mrs. T's pierogies right here. I actually had pierogies last week for lunch.
You guys are making me hungry. I love, fried potatoes are my favorite food.
Thank you for saying this, because this is another question I'm going to ask later on, is how you prefer your potatoes. So save that tidbit for when we talk about the history of the potato.
When Mike did a little explanation of like the description of the false potato beetle, but we didn't even describe the Colorado potato beetle.
It's true. So let's do that. That is, I have this broken up into several sections, and that's the first one, is what is Colorado potato beetle? So I would assume that many of our listeners have seen one, But just for the flair of it, the adult beetle is a distinct looking insect. They're not quite half an inch long. They have a prominent dome shape to them. Jody, you were mentioning you find it very aesthetically pleasing.
Yeah, it looks like a bead, like a really pretty bead. It's got some blotches, like spots and stripes. It's got different colors. It's like my yellowy orange and black. They kind of look like dome shaped, like a lady beetle, but bigger. I just think they're cute.
It looks like what a coleopteran is supposed to look like, right? That big domed back, kind of shiny elytra. It is colorful, kind of a yellowy orange color. They have 10 stripes that run down their back. A very important trait to compare to the false Colorado potato beetle, these 10 black stripes that go down the elytra. It also is referenced in their scientific name, Leptinotarsa dissimilineata, meaning 10 lines on the back, and also in another common name. They are sometimes called the, what was it again? The 10-striped spearmen in some circles. I think that's an interesting common name. Not sure where it came from necessarily. They also do have a Rorschach ink blot pattern on top of their thorax, these different kinds of dots that make a pattern on the top. The larvae are very different. Obviously, they have complete metamorphosis since they're a beetle. The larvae are puffy grubs. They are kind of fluffy looking. They start as a brick orange color, and then they will sort of become sort of salmony pink as they age. I think that they look a lot like the brain slug monsters from Starship Troopers. I think I even said that in the episode that we did on Starship Troopers.
Again, yeah, we did an episode on that if you guys want to go back and
listen. We're very self-referential today. Very big and kind of juicy on the back end. Jody called them the gushers earlier. They look like they would explode if you touch them. They also have two rows of black dots along the side of the abdomen. They are just very voracious feeders. They feed as an adult and as a larva on the plant. Beyond sort of the description of their appearance, I did want to say they're a leaf beetle. So they're a member of the family Chrysomelidae. And this is where I'm getting out. I'm just a humble country entomologist, as I like to say. And I will trust that our taxonomist resident will tell me if I say anything too untoward or egregious. And I will say, as with everything in entomology, you can't say, oh yeah, all of them have this or all of them have that. There's always an exception to the rule, right, Mike?
It's true. And I'm really glad that you pointed out that they feed on the same host. Because one of the things with complete metamorphosis, we say, oh, it happened because you get the larvae on one host and the adults on another host in this division of food sources helps with competition. You don't have life stages competing with one another, unlike things like true bugs that are feeding on the same food source. And it's really funny then that things like Colorado potato beetle are like, aha, we're done with that. Everybody, let's just eat potatoes. This is great.
This is a family affair. We're all going to live on this plant together. It is interesting to see that with this pest. And it's what doubles up the damage, unfortunately, with them. So Chrysomelidae, the leaf beetles, right, Mike? Mm-hmm. Fairly well known for feeding on plants.
Yeah, leaves. It's right there in the name.
Leaves right there in the name.
There's lots of pests that are leaf beetles.
It is a very pesty family, unfortunately. And I've got some of them written out here in a second, but yes, they love to bother us. Chrysomelids in particular are known for having typically a metallic coloration, a domed body shape, antennae that are less than half the length of their body, and unnotched eyes. Their tarsal formula, and this is something, Mike, I'm hopeful that you will pitch in on, is apparently 444, but is in truth 555. So what does that mean?
Yeah, Pseudotetramerus. This is a character that trips up all of the undergrad entomology students the first time they take taxonomy. It is a great character to show them. So the tarsal formula is just the number of segments on the tarsi. So the tarsi are, you could think of them as the feet of insects. And there's different numbers of segments in the feet. They can have one, they can have two, three, four, to a maximum of five. And so if you were to say a tarsal formula, it would be three numbers like 555 or 554. And that's the number of segments in the tarsi. So the first number is the prolegs. The second number is the middle legs. And the third number is the third pair of legs. So 554 would be 5 segments on the front legs, 5 segments on the back middle legs, and 4 segments on the hind legs. So 5-5-5, apparently 4-4-4, this pseudo tetrameris condition means that on all 3 leg segments, or all 3 legs, they have 5 segments, but apparently 4. And that's because the 3rd segment of the tarsi is bilobed and big, so it's big and expanded. The 4th segment is really small and kind of situated in the middle of that lobe. And then the 5th segment comes out of that 4th segment. So you have to look really closely between this lobed structure of the 3rd tarsal segment to see that little tiny 4th tarsal segment. So if you were just looking at it, it would look like it's 4-4-4. They've got this really tiny 4th segment, so they're 5-5-5.
Okay. A little bit of taxonomic trickery there on the
part. I'll see if I can find a good photo of it. Or maybe
that'll be good for the show notes. One.
Yeah, go check out the show notes. I'm sure by the time we post this, I'll have dug something up.
Some other Chrysomelidae factoids. It's one of the 5 largest families of beetles, from what I've read on Bug Guide and other places. Currently over 35,000 species described in the family. I was curious if, as a pop quiz, could you guys name the other 4 largest families beside Chrysomelidae?
Weevils.
Weevils, Curculionidae.
Inebrionids?
No.
No. Carabid?
Carabids, yes.
That was going to be my other guess.
2 more.
So that's 3 of the 4. Oh, that's...
Well, we have Chrysomelidae, Carabidae, and Curculionidae. One of them is very near and dear to your heart, Mike.
Oh, longhorns.
Yes, Cerambycidae. And then the last one is Staphylinids.
Oh, Staphylinids, of course, yeah.
The rove beetles. So that was based on the stuff that I was reading. I'd have no idea if, you know, taxonomy has completely altered those in the intervening 24 hours, and now one of those families doesn't exist.
I've actually described 10,000 species of Buprestids in the last day. So now they're number 3.
That'd be great. I would love for Buprestidae to rise up and take their proper place. Chrysomelids are also in a superfamily, Chrysomeloidea, which they share with the Cerambycids. Combining those two, since those are 2 of the biggest families, obviously makes it a pretty big superfamily. And we could zoom even farther out. They belong to a clade that the superfamily belongs to, the Phytophaga or Phytophaga. This big mama combines the Curculionids with the Byssids and the Chrysomelids, amongst others. So it's pretty big. And I really just wanted to bring it up because the clade name translates to plant gluttons. And I find that to be très magnifique. That's good naming there. Am I right so far, Mike? Are you going to be
correct? No, this is all correct.
All on board. Chrysomelids, in their herbivory, are the main reason that people really care about these insects. That was partially a segue to try and get to talk about how they do like to eat plants. Brucids are chrysomelids, and they feed on the seeds of legumes. We've got tortoise beetles, who, in addition to looking pretty dope, are leaf miners and gall makers, amongst other problems. We have asparagus beetles in the chrysomelids. Any guesses as to what they like to feed on?
Oak trees?
Asparagus?
Asparagus. Their pee smells very funny all the time because of it. And then flea beetles are also in this group, and they're problems for dozens and dozens of species of plants that we cultivate.
It's neat that you listed the brucines and the hispids, because both of those groups for a long time were like their own families.
Right.
But with phylogenetics, we've realized that they're just chrysomelids, so they're rolled in.
I think that this is what maybe I was referring to. I was texting Mike the other night, and I was trying to think back to when we took taxonomy. And I swore that I remembered Dr. Chris Oseto at Purdue being salty about something with chrysomelids, that something had been dumped in with them and he took umbrage with it, and maybe let us keep tortoise beetles separate or something.
Yeah, that would make sense, because that's okay. A reasonably recent change. I mean, reasonably last 20 years change. And they look fairly different. They do different things. Like you said, they're leaf miners most of the time, but they're not even their own subfamily within Chrysomelids. They're broken into multiple different tribes within another subfamily.
This is why we have you on the show, Mike, by the way. Also, I hate to break it to you, but 20 years ago was when we were taking taxonomy.
No, I know. It feels like it shouldn't be that long. I feel old.
I saw gray hair pop up in your beard just then.
Yeah.
The Colorado potato beetle specifically is in the subfamily Chrysomelinae. I'm not sure if I'm going to pronounce some of these correctly. These are the broad-bodied leaf beetles, as the name implies. The group is very famous for feeding on leaves, and the Colorado potato beetle is most famous for feeding on the leaves of potatoes. But it is important to note that that was not always the case. This is, for me, one of the interesting twists in its history that, when I started reading more about it, I had a hard time squaring how this could have ever been sort of a surprise, I guess. But when you start to read more about the history of the Colorado potato beetle and potatoes in particular, there are some sort of twists in the road that mean that they didn't necessarily meet up when you would have expected them to historically. So can I share with you the history of when the Colorado potato beetle was discovered?
Please do.
There is some controversy regarding where it originates from. Traditionally, they were considered to have come from the central highlands of Mexico, but I was reading a paper from 2017 that was in the Great Lakes Entomologist. It was a note on Colorado potato beetle feeding on a novel host that they hadn't seen before. And in that paper, they were referring to some other research that I couldn't get access to, unfortunately, that was saying that more modern researchers into Colorado potato beetle think that they do originate from the foothills of the Rocky Mountains in Colorado, which could sort of change some of the story that we've traditionally told about it. But ultimately, they're probably from between Colorado and Mexico, northern Mexico, somewhere.
Oh, that's interesting, because the story that I had in my head was they're from the Rocky Mountain foothills.
Yeah.
Which I don't know where and when I learned that, but that was like, if you would have asked me 5 minutes ago where I thought they were from, that's what I would have told you.
That would have been your Jeopardy answer.
Yeah. So that's interesting that I didn't realize there was debate.
There's debate. There's some saltiness there. This is also kind of interesting when you consider where the Colorado potato beetle is originally collected from and identified from. It was first collected by a British naturalist named Thomas Nuttall in 1811. He was a member of the Astor Expedition, which ran between 1810 and 1813, but the War of 1812 kind of made it collapse, which is, you know, to be expected, I would say. When your capital is being burned, scientific expeditions probably don't rank very high anymore. It was performed at the behest of the Pacific Fur Company, but it had lots of scientists who were cataloging life, including Nuttall. He did not, I guess, publish anything on the beetle and describe it, but it was known that he had acquired them and collected them. It wasn't until 1824 when Thomas Say, American entomologist extraordinaire, described the beetles in a publication to the Academy of Natural Sciences of Philadelphia. I can actually include a link in the show notes to the publication. It's been digitized, so you can read Say's original words on it. It's not a very auspicious publication for a pest that I would argue is sort of touched by history. It's short. It mainly notes the insect's coloration, the 10 lines on the elytra. He named it Dorophora desalineata. He collected the insects himself in 1819 or 20. He was serving as the zoologist for the Major Stephen H. Long expedition to the Rocky Mountains, one of the largest expeditions to the middle of the country that was ever accomplished. And in the publication, he notes that it was previously collected by Nuttall. I don't know how he knew that necessarily, but he says it's not uncommon in the upper Missouri. The variety I collected on the Arkansas. And I couldn't find what he meant by that, because all of the modern publications on the topic say he collected it on the Iowa-Nebraska border. So this has been confounding to me. The Arkansas, I read, was a colloquial term for Arkansas and Kansas in the past. Is it also like a river or something, Mike? You lived out there.
Yeah, I mean, there is an Arkansas River.
Right. So maybe that's, I'm not sure what he meant, but it may have also come from the Omaha area, Jody. It seems like in some people's views, it's something on the border.
I don't know what I read, but I read somewhere that it was discovered destroying potato crops 100 miles west of Omaha, Nebraska.
Yeah. So we will get to that part. Yes.
Okay. Okay.
That's a very fun part of the story as well. Like I said, Nebraska seems to feature quite a bit in this story. So he may have first collected it on the Nebraska border. Later on, Nebraska factors in when it becomes a pest. Regardless of their geographic provenance, it is known that they were collected feeding on plants that we call buffalo burr, also known as spiny nightshade, Solanum rostratum. We call that foreshadowing in the business. So it's a nightshade type plant. It's in the same genus as potatoes. This is going to be an important factor. It's related to tomatoes and eggplants as well. At the time of this collection and description, it would appear, though, that the humble potato had not quite yet met its current longtime nemesis. If you know anything about the potato, I think that would come as something of a surprise. I don't mean for this to necessarily become the tater cast here today, but I think this is kind of an interesting quirk of history that spans across continents. And I was curious, what do you guys know about the saga of the potato? What do you know about potato history, Jody and Mike?
I regret to inform you, I am very uneducated in potato history. I wish you would have told me last week that I should brush up on my history of
potatoes. No, I wanted an organic reaction to this question.
I'm surprised they don't know more about potatoes since I love them so much.
You do love a potato, and you are now going to be able to have a more deep and abiding love and understand them on a historical level. And I hope you're pumped.
Thank you in advance.
Mike, you look like you have something to say as well.
I know a bit. They originated from the Andes. That's mm-hmm. where they're like their center of diversity. There's something like 400 varieties there, something insane. And then they went to Europe before they got to North America, like the United States part of North America, which I always found surprising because, you know, you kind of assume corn went from Mesoamerica north. It's weird maybe that trade routes between native peoples didn't bring potatoes like into Mexico first. I would like historically that didn't happen, but it's a little maybe surprising to me that it didn't. And they never made it all the way up.
Yeah, hit upon, to me, what makes this a very interesting story, which is if the Colorado potato beetle was in this Colorado to Nebraska area, or Colorado, Nebraska down to Mexico area, and potatoes are from the Americas, like, how did they never meet? How did this never happen? And it does have some weird turns, and it does go from South America to Europe and back. It is, I hope, an interesting story. So the standard model potato, in our collective imagination and in Hobbit stew pots all over the Shire, is Solanum tuberosum. Is as with other domesticated plants and animals, it's got extensive research behind it to try and figure out and trace its origins. From what I've gathered, as Mike was saying, the current accepted theory is they were domesticated in the Andes Mountains near Lake Titicaca. Specifically, archaeological evidence puts the earliest signs of cultivation at about 7,000 years ago. And it centered on a group of 20 morphologically similar wild species referred to as the Solanum brevicular complex. This is according to a press release that I'll include in the show notes from the International Potato Center, which is headquartered down in South America. It's possible they could have been domesticated as far back as 10,000 years ago, but apparently tubers don't preserve very well in the fossil record, so they don't have the evidence to prove that. Potatoes were a very important foodstuff to the Andean people, including the Incan Empire, where they were considered a staple crop. They would prepare the potatoes in many of the same ways that we did and do. They boiled them, mashed them, and stuck them in stews, just like Samwise. But would further, to quote from the Wikipedia article on the history of the potato, quote, the Andean people also prepared a dish called papas secas, which was a process that involved boiling, peeling, and chopping. These potatoes were then fermented in order to create tokosh and ground to a pulp soaked and filtered into a starch referred as almidon de papa. However, the cash crop of the Andean people was chuno, created by letting potatoes freeze overnight, allowing them to thaw in the morning, which they repeated to soften the potatoes. Then farmers extracted the potatoes' water, leaving them much lighter and smaller. This new creation was later prepared into a stew, usually as an addition to the stew. Among its many benefits, chuno's primary benefit was that it could be stored for years without refrigeration, which came in handy during years of famine or bad harvest. Moreover, its long shelf life allowed it to be the staple food for Incan armies due to how well it maintained its flavor and longevity. What is your guys' favorite way to eat a potato?
I only get to pick one.
Top three for you, Jody.
Okay. So did you know that the sweet potato is not really a potato?
Yes.
Yes.
Come on, I didn't know that. So
that's you're learning not so much about your favorite
food. I am. Because I was looking up different ways to eat potatoes.
Yeah, they're related to like morning glories.
So French fries, specifically poutine, because I'm Canadian, but not.
I'm glad you got that in there.
Not the fancy poutine that they have here in the States. This is like street food, like real, right, Canadian poutine.
I didn't realize we had fancy poutine in America.
Yeah, no, there's always like lobster gravy and like chives and stuff. No, it's just cheese curds, brown gravy, french fries.
Got it. Delicious.
Let's see. So that would be like my all around every meal kind of totally unhealthy way to eat potatoes. I would say like dinner time, baked potatoes.
Man, I've come around on baked potatoes. When I was a kid, when my mom would make baked potatoes, it was just the potato and like maybe we could have some country crock butter spread. But I didn't know that you could do all this other stuff to them. And as a grown-up, I've come around on the baked potato. It's a great way to eat a potato.
It's like what they do with froyo, right? You can have, I mean, maybe not gummy bears and whatever, strawberries, but like you can put a lot of things on a potato. I would say breakfast potato. Hash brown.
Yeah. Oh, man. Not unless hash browns.
And those would be my top three.
Nice. Mike?
I'd forgotten how many types of potatoes you could have. So I'm going to have to say hash browns.
Okay.
Mashed taters.
Nice.
But only if I can have either gravy or corn with them. Mashed potatoes, like just plain by themselves.
Do you mix it all together? Like, do you mix the corn and gravy and all? And it's like this big mash.
Yes.
Mush. Oh, okay.
I actually got yelled at in Boy Scouts for doing that because one of the dads thought it was disgusting. And then my dad was like, you don't mix your potatoes with corn. And he like gave us both a disgusted look. And it is one of the few memories from childhood that has stuck with me.
He sounds like a sectional eater. And that's a sign of an immature palate.
That makes sense. And then if I have to pick one that I don't get to have on a daily basis, it would be French fries, but specifically potato patch fries from Kennywood, which is a theme park outside of Pittsburgh, because they are deep fried and covered in gravy and so terrible for you and yet so delicious.
I think what I'm actually hearing is that you guys don't necessarily like potatoes as much as you like gravy.
Well, what kind of gravy do they put on those potatoes?
Like a brown gravy.
A brown gravy. See, it's brown gravy. I would like to know how you like your potatoes, but I also have questions about hash browns. Do you like the hash browns that are in like solid, you know, like patty form? Do tater tots count as hash browns if it's for breakfast? Or do you like when they're all like mushed up and fried, like when you go down to whatever that restaurant is down
Waffle
the street?
House. I'm a shoestring hash brown person.
Yeah,
I would say that like tater tots and tater tot patties don't necessarily count. It's more, it's like congealed, right? And then cubed hash browns, that has another name, right? Home fries or?
American fries.
Something like
that. They were just, because like when they call it corned beef and hash, aren't those all cut up somehow? I don't know. I don't know what
I did not do enough research
are.
On this site.
I will say, I saw somebody on Twitter was made fun of for bringing latkes to like a Christmas holiday academic function. They were like, why would you bring these Jewish foods to this Christmas party? And I was like, ooh, latkes, I've never had that. So I made some.
Delicious.
And obviously, I'm not Jewish. So like, they're not as good as somebody that has had them their whole lives made. But my goodness, whatever, I followed a latke recipe and they are amazing. So they might actually be in my top three.
Nice.
And they're like a potato pancake, shredded potatoes with a binder and egg.
That sounds delicious.
It's so good. Like, I don't know why you would not want those. They're so good.
I want those right now. Okay, Jonathan, carry on.
Oh, my favorite potatoes?
Yes.
Baked is probably up there now. I like fried potatoes with like pork chops. That was a meal growing up in my house. Hash browns are hard to beat. Like you crack a sunny side up egg open, mix it up with some hash browns. I hope people aren't listening to this with an empty belly, or that they are, and that they go and enjoy a delicious potato.
This has been the Arthropod Foodcast.
This is the Arthro Potato Cast. Potatoes were one of many plants, animals, and pathogens that ultimately comprised the Columbian Exchange, meaning that the Spanish took them from their native range in South America and introduced them to Spain, likely in the 1570s. This is all sort of hinky. Some of this history that I'm sharing now, it seems some of it's apocryphal, borderline mythical, because in British history, it is often said, though I saw it sort of heavily debated, and there's two versions of this story, so pick which one you like the best and go with it. Either Sir Francis Drake may have introduced the potato to the British Isles, or an associate of Sir Walter Raleigh named Thomas Harriot. He's also credited by some. As for a location that became synonymous with potatoes, Ireland, they may have been introduced in one of a couple ways. It could have also been Sir Walter Raleigh involved with that one. But another tale that I read was that they were first actually introduced by Basque fishermen who had potatoes in their hold. This was after the 1570s, like the 1590s thereabouts. And they were sailing and they caught a bunch of cod and they docked in Ireland and then like gave a bunch of potatoes away to the people there. And then they started getting grown in Ireland. And potatoes apparently struggled in Spain and other continental European locations. There was a mismatch sort of in climate and summer for the potato, and they didn't yield potatoes early enough to actually be harvested. But they found sort of purchase in Ireland's climate where the people were able to grow them, and farmers in Ireland over about 100 years of time were cultivating and producing more varieties of potato, the most famous of which became known as the Irish Lumper. Have you heard of the Irish Lumper, Mike?
I have not.
It's a great name for a potato, I would argue. It is the potato that features in the history of the Great Famine in Ireland. So later in Irish history, potatoes had become a staple crop for people to feed on, to eat, I should say. They're not insects, so I shouldn't say feed on. They were growing potatoes in various corners of their properties while all of the other food that farmers were growing in Ireland was taxed from them. There were a lot of sort of draconian British policies in place at the time of the Great Famine, and potatoes were kind of the only thing that was left to the people that were native to Ireland. And so when a potato blight came through and wiped out the potatoes that they were surviving on, and all of their other food was kind of stolen by the English and taken to London for sale and for consumption, there wasn't anything left for the Irish people to eat. I'm trying to put this delicately because it is of course, controversial. Irish people would argue that that's the truth of it, is that the British really caused it, that there was plenty of food, but it was taken from them. And British people say, no, it's because they couldn't grow potatoes properly. I know which side I stand on, but Mike is nodding his head.
Yeah, I've always heard like, oh yeah, the Irish potato famine was caused by this pathogen. They don't tell you the rest of it, and I only learned the rest of it in like the last 2 years, and it seems real obvious when you hear that. You're like, I mean, I can see how this pathogen would be a problem in that potatoes were a staple crop, but like they had other food, my dudes.
Well, and the blight went through other countries, and we didn't get a great famine there because they just pivoted to other crops. So, yeah, I think it's even important, the name. Like people are trying to switch from the potato famine to just the Great Famine, I think, because it's more evocative of what actually happened.
Do you know much of the other history of potatoes in Europe? And I only ask because I know, like, writing and reading about Napoleon, when they get into Poland, like potatoes are a big thing in Poland, but I don't know much beyond like the Poles love themselves some potatoes too.
Mike, thank you for the great setup to continue my story of
Perfect. There you go. I'm about to get this answered then.
Elsewhere in Europe, potatoes were not initially popular with people. They were regarded with suspicion due to their novelty. They came from a different continent. That's weird. And their relation to nightshade. They were frequently referred to as devil's apples since they grew underground and their nightshade origins tied them to witches. It's pretty metal, right? That would make me want to eat a potato. Failures of other crops, the little ice age, and the net caloric benefits of potatoes compared to other foodstuffs and their production. Also pushes by nobles and royalty to shift opinion on potatoes where they would grow them and say you can't have them, which made people want them. And apparently French royalty took to actually wearing potato flowers to large events to sort of publicize the beauty of potatoes, which made them sort of fashionable. And then interest in the potato took off. So yes, Mike, eventually people on the mainland, on European continent, they eventually become quite taken with potatoes just because of all of those benefits. By the end of the 1700s thereabout, that's where this public opinion shift has occurred. Subsequently, it is, of course, brought by Europeans to North American colonies. And there was the first recorded harvest of potatoes by white people in North America in New Hampshire in 1719. At this point, there were many who considered the potato completely European. They viewed it as a European crop that was imported to North America. This included the third American president, who I think we have dogged on this show before. Is that right, Mike?
We could dog on him some more. I'm down for it.
So Thomas Jefferson was once in an argument about potatoes. No surprise there. Everybody has it happen to him. And he said, quote, "You say the potato is a native of the U.S. I presume you speak of the Irish potato. I have inquired much into this question and think I can assure you that the plant is not a native of North America. It came from Ireland," which is wrong. The Irish lumper did, so maybe that's what he's arguing, but ultimately it is not from Ireland. I also wanted to point out that in Asia, the potato arrived in the 1600s, so it spread across Eurasia pretty quickly, within like two generations of people, basically. And it became very common in China and India. And that's very important to point out because these are now the two national leaders globally in potato production. China is number one. India is number two. I wanted to cap off my potato history bit with some quotes from an article from the BBC. They were interviewing the author Rebecca Earle, who published a book titled Feeding the People, The Politics of the Potato. So she says, despite its origins in the Andes, it's an incredibly successful global food. It's grown practically everywhere in the world, and practically everywhere, people consider it one of our, internal quote, our foods. For the rest of the world beyond the Andes, the potato might not be original from there, but it feels local. Rebecca Earle says it's the world's most successful immigrant. As its origin has become unrecognizable for producers and consumers everywhere. Idaho farmers in the U.S. and gnocchi-loving Italians will claim the potato as much as any Peruvian, because its story is not only that of a country or of a region, but an account of how humans have reconfigured their relationship with land and food within a few generations. So I think that there's another quote from France where they basically say that the potato is French, like it's one of the chief French foods, and so they claim it. Poland also has a long history with the potato, and I think that it's become beloved. Just based on the conversation we had mere moments ago, we all three love the potato. Everybody claims it, right?
Yes.
Everybody wants a piece of it.
And yet, when you talk about like, hey, what's your top three favorite vegetables? Like in general, I'm not sure a lot of people would list the potato, and yet it's kind of ubiquitous. It's so ubiquitous as to be like, I don't know. You guys feel that way? Like I wouldn't necessarily list the potato as one of my favorite vegetables.
Yeah.
And yet it's everywhere and I eat it all the time.
It's such an important member of multiple meals, but it's never really the star, right? I mean, the baked potato bar that Jody was referencing before with her yogurt analogy, I mean, occasionally you do see that, but potatoes are usually added to things or have things added to them in order to make them more palatable. So they're not delicious, but like the calories that we get from them and everything. I mean, that's what the guy in The Martian eats, right? He survives on Mars for however long with just potatoes. So they are a very powerful food because of that, even though they're not necessarily the most flavorful or delicious.
Yeah, I think I don't even remember how this turned out, but like a debate on if you could only have one food for the rest of your life, what would it be? And I think someone had said potatoes, and that's probably the whole Martian thing. This is years before that. I don't think you can get all your nutrients out of it, but like if it was bread, you still have to put that together, assemble it, bake it with potato. Right. It's a potato.
It's like an apple. It's like, it's all right there. and you can just bite into it.
Right. And I guess I wouldn't even consider it a vegetable. So I wouldn't think about it that way. I guess I just see it as a starch.
It is. Yeah. And it is one of the top four things produced in the world, right?
Yeah. Sorry, potatoes. I'm so sorry. I've just ignored you.
I think everybody has. Everybody forgets the humble potato until it's dinner time. The reason I included all of this potato history isn't just because I think it's fun, but it shows that there could have been some naivete of potatoes and the Colorado potato beetle. Like maybe the twain had never met. The beetle is historically known in Mexico, as we referred to. There was potato cultivation in central Mexico. It did make it up that far. Some pubs I read say that Spanish settlers accidentally introduced the buffalo burr to the United States further north with the movement of cattle and horses, and the beetle just sort of naturally followed it from Mexico. Those were people who consider it to be a Mexican species that moved further north. And it should be noted that while potatoes were domesticated in South America, they likely weren't cultivated across most of North America. There was a potato relative that was grown and eaten by native peoples, such as the Pueblo, Ute, and Diné. It's called the Four Corners potato. It's smaller. It's a different species. It has some of the same attributes, such as a long shelf life and high nutrition, but it is resistant to many of the diseases that affect the classic potato in our minds. And it also survives better in heat and drought. So there is some research into it being a climate change crop, something that we may be able to grow in places that are going to be getting really harshed by climate change. But more germane to our purposes, the Four Corners potato is resistant to the Colorado potato beetle. So if that was what was...
I could grow it here, is what you're saying.
Yes, you could. You could, absolutely.
Well, I'm going to have to worry about some potatoes this year.
There you go. If you can find some Four Corners potatoes online, I highly encourage you to do so. So there's a bunch of research into this. I'm actually going to include some show notes with links to articles on this potato, because some of it's just been happening in like the last 5 to 7 years where people have been learning more about this. But to cap off our history, the Colorado potato beetle historically fed on buffalo burr, as we've said. And it had not made a host switch to the Four Corners potato, nor did it feed on potatoes in Mexico. But that luck would not hold out, as Manifest Destiny agriculture and beetles all meet in the middle of America. Jody, you mentioned earlier when you were reading about the Colorado potato beetle, you read something about 100 miles west of Omaha. This is when the beetle breaks bad. This is when it has its first outbreak on potatoes. This happened in 1859. Before Nebraska was even an official state, which occurred in 1867, the papers I read, many of them said that it, quote, happened near Omaha. But when you read in more detail, it's about 100 miles west of Omaha, the first site. Jody, how do you think people 100 miles west of Omaha would feel about being called essentially from Omaha?
That's not close to Omaha.
Nope. I actually looked it up. I wanted to see if there were any
cities.
Where
is that?
The closest one that I could find that's still an extant city is called Clark's, but it's almost to Grand Island, basically. Grand Island is over 100 miles away, but somewhere out there.
That's where our state fair is.
Yep. But I don't think those people would be like, oh yeah, I'm pretty much from Omaha, right?
Yeah. 2 hours away. No, that's not Omaha.
I'm not saying that that's exactly the location where it happened. I couldn't find that information about like what city was next to it, but I think it's interesting to read how people lump things together in Nebraska.
So
go ahead.
How did they get here? like so kid.
If they're from the foothills of the Rockies in Colorado, it's not that big of a jump to be in Nebraska as well, feeding on buffalo burr. So it seems like they were just sort of there. And then around this time, potato production is also ramping up, probably at forts and white settlers locations. And so now there's potato there, and they start feeding on it. They pretty much are wiping it out. It's just all this ragged damage. From what I've read, there isn't necessarily an exact mutation that occurred in the insect that caused this to be possible. It should be noted there are differences. If you look at beetles collected from Mexico, like further south today, and beetles from the eastern United States, the Mexican beetle populations show clear preferences for feeding and ovipositing on wild Solanum species, particularly buffalo burr, while American species prefer feeding on and ovipositing on potato. But they can still breed together and produce viable offspring. So they're still one species. Right, Mike?
Yes. at least under the biological species concept. But I mean, that makes sense. Like, you see other host switching events with, apple maggots from hawthorns. They host switch, but those ones don't interbreed anymore because there's a temporal switch.
Okay. But it's important to point out that it's all of the Colorado potato beetle researchers are very adamant about this. It's not a host shift because the potato feeding individuals, if you put them on buffalo burr, they'll eat it. So it's just a range expansion rather than a total host shift, which is cool, right?
Yeah. Yeah. They're all Solanum, so they're close enough.
Right.
And just feed on them.
But these ones from America, they seem to be like, oh yeah, no, potatoes, that's where it's at. I'm quoting from a paper a book chapter that I mentioned earlier about pests of potatoes. They say, quote, Harrison, a paper in 1987, hypothesized that the relaxation of stabilizing selection in newly colonized areas resulted in populations of more generalist feeders taking advantage of local Solanum species. Unfortunately, that included the cultivated potato. Another possible hypothesis is that a certain number of genotypes in ancestral Colorado potato beetle populations were specifically pre-adapted to feeding on potato. This increased ability to feed on potato foliage in derived populations has been the result of directional selection, with an increase in the frequency of potato-adapted genotypes at the expense of less adapted genotypes. Can you translate that for people, Mike?
I think, well, it's just, I think what they're saying is, like, in this part of the country, you just got more potatoes growing as a host compared to other potential hosts. Like, there's no buffalo burr here. So as these beetles spread east, you're going to select for the genotypes that are preferentially feeding on them. But, like, there's not so much selection that they can't go back and feed on buffalo burr if they can encounter it, which they can't here. But out west, they could.
Succinctly said. I love it. Regardless of the mechanism behind how Colorado potato beetle broke bad, they now suddenly took on the behavior of an almost invasive species. Following this first discovery in Nebraska, they began spreading east at a rate of almost 140 kilometers per year. They crossed the Mississippi in 1865. They reached Ohio in 1869 and were in Maine by 1872. They proceeded into the southern provinces of Canada, which were colonized by 1901. So 1859 to 1901, that is not a long period of time to suddenly be all over the place. I'm going to show you guys, and this will be in the show notes as well, a map of this. Can you see the map?
Oh, that's really cool.
Yeah. So the rate of spread was quite rapid, starting from Nebraska all the way east. By 1876, according to this publication, they were all the way to Massachusetts. So not even 20 years. That is pretty astonishing when you think about it.
That's really fast, but also they're moving west to east, which is like the prevailing wind currents, and they can fly. So I can imagine, like, it would have been a lot slower going the other direction if wind wasn't helping them a lot of the time.
Mike, you were on fire today with these segues. The beetle did also move west, but at a much slower rate. The quote, first serious damage to potatoes in Colorado was reported in 1875. However, 10 years earlier, a publication, Walsh, 1865, saw considerable beetle populations feeding on buffalo burr in Colorado. The observation eventually resulted in the name of that state being incorporated into the generally accepted common name of this species. There were also fewer potatoes out west, further west, so that slowed it down. But I wanted to know if it was first found in Nebraska being a problem. It should be the Nebraska potato beetle, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. But apparently this other Colorado stuff and some publications on it is what led to the common name. And the maybe it's provenance from the foothills of the Rocky Mountains.
It's interesting that this is happening like the same time Rocky Mountain locusts are happening.
Yeah. People probably thought it was the end of the world, right?
But can't grow corn, can't grow potatoes.
Further, between 1860 and 1880, the range of CPB expanded more than 4 million square kilometers. Potato power, am I right? To further a quote from the Insect Pests of Potatoes, Chapter 2, quote, all in all, the beetles range between 1860 and 1880 expanded by more than 4 million square kilometers. Colonization in North America was completed in 1919 when the beetles were found in British Columbia, Canada. So that's it for America, North America. It's fully infested by this beetle. Potatoes are getting eaten up. The damage that they cause is defoliation. It's mostly the result of final instar larval feeding. I think that's when about 70% of the damage that they produce is occurring. The leaves are notched at first by the smaller larva and then become completely ragged as defoliation continues. Potatoes can handle up to 30% defoliation until they're trying to like grow the tubers underground, and then they can only withstand 10% tolerance. So you could see how this would become a big problem for people counting on taters for dinner. Is that what you see on your plants there, Mike?
I don't know. I haven't grown them.
Well, I meant on the weeds, I should say.
Oh, you know, they don't actually seem to hurt the bittersweet nightshade that much. Like, there's certainly defoliation and beetles all over the place, but that stuff just grows so fast. And also, they're not trying to put their energy into tubers.
Right.
Which is, like, I imagine potato plants can survive some level of damage. They just won't make the tubers that we want that are so starch and energy filled. Like, you could have a potato that survives, it just has no tubers, but that's still not useful.
Right. So I'm going to try and wrap this up in the next 30 minutes, but I hope that people will stick with us if it goes further than that. Because now we're...
Hey, man, I set the precedent. One episode turned into six, so...
That's true. Maybe we'll become the CPB podcast. What we're transitioning to from now is from the Americas. Now we're going to start looking globally. I titled this section, Now It's Your Guys' Problem Too. I don't know if you both feel like this, but I feel like almost all of my extension programming lately has been about invasive species. It seems like the only topic I get requested to speak on anymore. And it's always different ones, but it just seems like it's all the time. Like, do you feel like that?
Yeah. I mean, that's like, it's the question that I get probably the most.
Right.
I don't
Japanese
know if I get...
beetles. There's so many of them to choose from.
Yes.
Mike, how about you?
I get a lot. I do a lot of invasive species programming, but almost all of it is, is invasive forest pests. Like, I don't get a whole lot of like other things. It's almost all tree and forest pests.
Yeah. I get a lot of street tree pests and then home invaders like stink bugs and lady beetles. And
I do get some of those. You know, with a lot of the invasive species I talk about, so many of them, especially if I'm doing like a 30-minute talk, but 3-minute segments on like 10 different pests. So it's like a broad overview of a bunch of different invasives. A lot of them are like, and this comes from China, this comes from Japan, this comes from Southeast Asia, this comes from Asia, that comes from Asia. And I've gotten the question multiple times, like, why is all this stuff coming from Asia? It's like, right. Well, all the stuff we get from Europe's been here for 200 years.
Yep. Yep. And we have a similar climate to a lot of Asia. So
yeah, like there's just increased trade from Asia. To this episode, it's interesting to see something that we have sent outwards.
You were killing this, Mike. That's actually the second most popular question that I get. The first one is, why are they all from Asia? And then the second one is, do we ever give as good as we've gotten in the invasive trade? And I tend to focus on fall armyworm.
Fall armyworm.
Yeah, I say, yeah, we've sent that abroad. But Colorado potato beetle is the other one that we definitely are very culpable for. And it has become a problem globally. So North America is considered sort of fully hit by 1919, but then Colorado potato beetle had tried to go global before that. It first popped up in England in 1875 near some docks in Liverpool. And then there were a bunch of quarantines that were put in place so that this wouldn't get loose. And so it's never actually gotten established in the British Isles, apparently. If you look at the maps now, yeah, it is still considered a priority pest for Ireland in particular. But they don't seem to be listed as infested. In 1877, a discovery was found in continental Europe. And then there was another find in Poland 1 year later in 1878. Quarantines and bans on importing American potatoes spared Europe's potatoes from Colorado potato beetle until the end of World War I. So we were late entrance into the war, but we did show up and we brought a bunch of stuff with us. And unfortunately, in that stuff were some life stage of Colorado potato beetle. And it became established in the Bordeaux region of France by 1922. So that's the epicenter for the spread. It spread across Western and Central Europe, and it reached Germany and Poland in the 40s and 50s. There's another cool map that I can show you that'll be in the show notes of this spread. So you can see it starts here in 1922, and then it spreads across France over the next kind of 10 years, and then it gets all the way out into Eastern Europe in the 1960s. So that is an interesting story in of itself. The history of the Colorado potato beetle as it gets into the Eastern European countries, it becomes something of a political fiasco. It was detected first in the Soviet Union in 1949, but it was eradicated and kept out of the Soviet Union proper until 1958. Before that, though, there were ongoing problems in other communist countries. Specifically, East Germany had a bunch of issues and a rich history dealing with Colorado potato beetle. They were known to be in Germany before and during World War II. Like, it was a pest that people were dealing with. But with the onset of the Cold War in the 50s, this beetle from the West started to take on sort of sinister proportions to a lot of the communist world. In 1950, nearly half of the potato fields in Soviet-occupied German territory were infested with Colorado potato beetle. This, I think, is to be expected after so much movement, the loss of all the quarantines during the war, no ban on bringing potatoes in, and a bunch of Americans coming in, probably with a bunch of bugs on accident. So this makes sense. People were focused on destroying the Nazis, something we should probably get into the spirit of again nowadays. But they were not focused on this bug as much anymore. So to further kind of paint the scene in East Germany, they are settling into this post-war world, into the Cold War. They don't have a lot of pesticides at this point, even though DDT is kind of riding high. If they are making DDT in East Germany, it's almost all being taken by the Soviet Union. And so they don't have much to spray. Further, many of the people who had been farmers in Eastern Germany had become soldiers in the war. And that means that they were Nazis. And the Soviets didn't have a lot of time for those kind of folks. And so they had taken many of these men prisoner, and they were in hard labor in the USSR. So it's like old people, women, and kids mainly left behind in East Germany. And it leaves potato agriculture at that moment kind of prone. Nerves are also frayed because there's this great imperialist enemy just across the border, right? The United States and all of the NATO allies. Not only is the U.S. seen as a bad guy to these people, but it's also where this beetle came from, is from America. And so in this milieu, there's a lot of reports that start to surface of low-flying American aircraft in East German skies. And there was a farmer in 1950, on May 23rd, 1950, farmer Max Traeger noticed two American planes flying over his fields in the East German village of Schönefels bei Zwickau. The next morning, according to East German government leaflets, he was shocked to discover that his fields were covered with Colorado potato beetles, an insect which can devastate potato crops. Where do you think this is going? Use your conspiracy brains.
they're going to blame it on Americans bomb dropping potato beetles.
Yep. They even have jars that they're holding up in photo shoots and saying that they're recovering these from the sites and that these are what the beetles are coming out of. This becomes something of a conspiracy theory amongst communist nations. There were strong assertions from the East Germans and other nations that the U.S. was purposely introducing the beetles in attempt to starve and weaken them. There were even statements in official government publications, which I will link to. Some of the German propaganda has been digitized. And in this, they basically say Colorado potato beetle is no different from an atomic weapon. And it's being used in the installation of gangster diplomacy. And that it, quote, shows everyone the true face of the deadly enemy of progressive humanity and of world peace. Strong words. Basically saying we're trying to kill them all.
It seems crazy on the face of it. But also, like, if you're a government that is stealing all of the insecticide that your your puppet country produces and you can't, like, control your pests,
mm-hmm.
It seems like a good scapegoat. Like, it's our problem. Like, yeah. They did it. Like, I can see how the government would be like, yeah, this is, like, yep. Internally be like, this is great. Blame them.
They totally lead into it. They all start to call it the Yankee beetle or the Amikoffer. In the old DDT episodes that we did, I showed you guys some propaganda posters that talked about this diabolical plot and had stylized the Beatles as having American stars and stripes. I don't know if you remember that.
Yeah, I do. That was a picture in my head now.
I'm pretty sure I was in error in that episode. I said they were made during the Nazi regime. In truth, they were more from this era. They're communist works. They're still metal as all get out, though. I found some more, if you guys are willing to look at them.
Heck yeah.
All right. So we've got the one with the stars and stripes. Halt, Amikoffer. Stop the American beetle. Stop the Yankee beetle. Octet Amdane Kartoffelkoffer. That means potato beetle. Got to make him stop. Here's one with the plane dropping the beetles as this like jet stream of devouring insects coming down. Then we've got... they're stealing our work, basically, our biter, Kartoffelkoffen. It's a saboteur coming in. And you can see on these beetles, they're red, white, and blue. And all of the heads are Uncle Sam and American soldiers and other political figures from the United States. I wanted to point out this isn't just in East Germany. I found a bunch of other countries that were producing this. This is a political cartoon that shows Czechoslovakians being infested with the Colorado potato beetle by an evil capitalist. And on the other hand, the Korean continent is being hit with bombs. So the equation here is the same, that the beetles are just as bad as the armaments that the Americans produce. Poland is a fertile ground for communist propaganda against the beetle. This is a poster saying, stop Stanka, the Colorado potato beetle, with some stylized drawings of it. We have a worker's fist pounding them into mush, and the heads of all the beetles are like Winston Churchill, Harry Truman, other political figures of the NATO world of the day. I believe this is Douglas MacArthur right here.
Yeah, like obviously caricatures, but what people of the day would instantly recognize.
Yep, and then I think this is like a capitalist pig here. This is maybe my favorite one. It's a skeleton Uncle Sam hand with a potato beetle cufflink, spreading the beetles through potato fields in Poland, spreading death and destruction. Here's a political cartoon where the soldiers of America, the military police, are Colorado potato beetles with dollar buck signs on their stripes instead of the spots at the top. Then, the other things that I can show you here real fast. These are from pamphlets that they gave to East German children about what to do after school. You're supposed to put on this uniform and you would go out and you would pick Colorado potato beetles from the field. And you were supposed to put them in bottles of spirits. So here you can see cartoon capitalist beetles being killed by various spirits. and this was something that was widely produced. There's an article from the BBC that's all about this war on the potato beetle. I wanted to quote from it. So the BBC article talks about how there were pamphlets and bulletins telling the German communist people that they had the power to destroy this pest. There were special drives to get the youth into fields and physically remove the larvae and adults. These were called Sondersuchtage, special search days. It was expected that after the school day had concluded, you would go out and do this. And quote, children all over East Germany were sent out to collect the beetles after school. We were told that the beetles were pests and that they were eating our fields bare, says Ingo Materna, who was 18 at the time. We would go down the rows of potatoes and everyone would try to pick up as many beetles as they could, maybe 20 or 25 in a day. And then we would put them in pots or little glass jars and they would be taken away and destroyed. I found that a very interesting quote, because if you're being killed out by Colorado potato beetles, wouldn't you be able to pick more than 25 in a day, like individually?
Yeah.
Yeah. Jody, how many Japanese beetles were you picking off of your peach tree in a day to save it?
I don't know, 400.
Yeah, yeah. Off of one tree in 1 yard.
It also seems like you could do something more useful than destroy them. Like, can we use larvae as like chicken food or something?
Maybe.
Are they toxic?
I don't think
they're feeding
so.
On it.
Things will eat them.
Solanum, which is toxic, but like, they are, if they're not, water. Just give them to chickens or something. Like, there's some, instead of like throwing them away.
That's a good point. I hadn't thought of that. There was some other stuff that I was reading that was talking about how this was really ramping up, and that may account for some of these numbers. And there were even some communist pamphlets that seemed to say, like, there were 18 last year and now there's 180 this year and 1,000 next year. It's like pointing out that this is getting worse, which to us sounds like a normal invasive species problem, right? But does seem kind of insidious, right? I will also say that there is no evidence that the U.S. did this on purpose at all. Nobody has ever proven this. Colorado potato beetle is perfectly capable of spreading on its own. What happened in Europe is very consistent with what happened in the United States. And we would expect to see that expansion type with Europe and Asia. But the case for the U.S. and NATO is not helped by a couple of different facts. Apparently, it was uncovered eventually that the British had researched in World War II if they could weaponize Colorado potato beetle against the Germans. So there was some paperwork that seemed to indicate that the thought had occurred to NATO allies before. And then I would say it was further hurt. Our credibility was further hurt when our old buddies at the CIA caught wind of all of this blame. They issued a tepid denial of it. And then they went to their West German allies and they convinced them to print postcard-sized replicas of Colorado potato beetles and emblazon them with words like freedom and then drop them from planes over East German cities.
Why? What's the point?
It's like a troll move, man. Also, I think it hurts because it's like, oh, so you can drop things from planes into our cities and we can't stop you. Like, I could see why that would fuel the paranoia.
That just seems so weird to me.
It feels like there's a good alternate history. Like, maybe we can get Harry Turtledove to write it. Like, where the doughboys don't get involved in World War I, and so we don't drop Colorado potato beetles off. And so they never make it to Europe. So what are the ramifications later?
It would be an interesting world full of more potatoes.
Like, is it worse because the America never sends troops and so World War I turns out different? Or is it better because there's never these potato beetle-linked famines?
I mean, it's a good question. There is a statue I wanted to show you as well. And I'll put this in the show notes. Do you see this potato beetle?
Oh, that's cool.
So this is in Hungary. This is in Hungary at the site of where it was first discovered there. I just thought this was really cool because it's a lot like the boll weevil statue in Enterprise, Alabama, where it's like these people are paying some respect to an entomological enemy. And so they erect a statue in its sort of honor, I guess.
I hope we find more giant pest beetle statues for our world. Like, is it just these two?
Send them in to us.
If you know our listeners where they're at.
We're going to get a lot of pictures from Alabama. In that city, they also painted statues of boll weevils, and one of them is painted like Ronald McDonald at a McDonald's. I've seen that a few times. So I'm just going to kind of quickly speed through the 60s to today. The Colorado potato beetle now lives from Spain all the way through Russia into Western China. It's also spread south, going into Iran, Tajikistan, and Afghanistan. That was actually something that happened during the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan. NATO allies spread Colorado potato beetle there, potentially.
Are you kidding me?
Well, that's what Afghani officials claimed, maybe even Taliban officials, now that I think about it. But it is possible they also just came from Tajikistan. One nation that has also dealt with Colorado potato beetles in that interim time is Ukraine. It's there that I kind of want to take a different look at some cultural implications of Colorado potato beetle. So this section is entitled Polrady or Kolorad. The Ukrainian citizens are still fighting against Russian aggression. They're also dealing with Russian sympathizers within their nation. This is something that Mike interviewed a guest about a year ago, just about, right?
Yeah, two guests, in fact.
Two guests. We had two different guests that talked about the war in Ukraine. They have the Colorado potato beetle there. I couldn't find an exact date for when it arrived in Ukraine, but in Ukraine, it's called, I'm not going to say this right, but Koloradskie Zuki, or Kolorady for short. So we've discussed the coloration of the beetle, the stripes in particular, and the kind of yellow-orange color and the black stripes. And in sort of a historical quirk, there is a strong visual similarity between the Colorado potato beetle and a Russian award for military valor called the St. George's Ribbon. Mike, are you aware of this?
No.
Okay, so there's this ribbon that was given to people who were veterans. It was very famous after World War II as something that people from Russia, from the Soviet Union, were receiving as an indicator of their military valor. But in modern times, it has now become more associated with pro-Russian sentiments. It's actually sort of like a quiet signal of people's true feelings about Putin and Russian aims. People wear it as sort of like I'm a part of this crowd. I believe Ukraine should be a part of Russia. I don't know a good analog, because all I can think of is like somebody wearing the Stars and Bars here, which is pretty loud and obvious that you have racist sentiments, perhaps. I'm not sure of a quieter version here in America.
What about like the three percenter symbols? Like some people, if you know what it is,
right?
If you know what it is.
Yeah, that's a good point.
If you don't, it's like, oh, well, I don't understand what that means.
I think what's interesting about this is that due to the similarity of this ribbon, actually, I wanted to show you guys it real fast. And again, in the show notes. So this is the ribbon on an award. And then this is it in a video from Russia. Do you guys see how this could be sort of looked at and be like, that's the Colorado potato beetle?
Yeah, it's brown and orange stripes.
Yeah, especially when it's folded like this. I thought it looked very striking, but it was very similar to the Colorado potato beetle. So with that visual similarity, the people of Ukraine have started to use Kolorady, the term that they have for Colorado potato beetle, as a derisive term for Ukrainians that have pro-Russian sentiments, that are separatists, basically. There's an article from Radio Free Europe that says, quote, Ukraine's pro-Russia separatists who wear unmarked military uniforms and deny any formal ties to the Russian government have relied on the orange and black ribbons as a kind of makeshift marker of Kremlin loyalty, end quote. When separatist troops first entered When separatist troops first entered eastern Ukraine earlier this month, most did so with one or more St. George ribbons tied around their biceps or pinned to their jackets, a useful visual for the Kremlin, which has tried to portray the current unrest in Ukraine as a heroic World War II-style battle against fascist influences in Kyiv and Western Ukraine. So it's kind of twofold. It's a visual metaphor for being like, oh yeah, we're with Russia, we're wearing this Russian symbol. But it helps Russia because their whole story is they're trying to take out fascists, right? And so if you use a World War II era symbol for that, it kind of helps to get that message across better. And it makes them feel more like the good guys. Have I missed anything about the Ukrainian war, Mike?
No.
Okay. I don't want to misrepresent it, but basically these ribbons have made them look like beetles. And then beyond that, people of Ukraine, they have been using Colorado potato beetles as a metaphor to show where Russia is currently holding territory. So they'll like put them on the map eating different cities as the Russians, kind of like when we produce quarantine maps. And I couldn't actually read the insecticide ad because it was in Ukrainian. And I think I accidentally went to like Ukrainian 4chan and was reading a bunch of stuff about this, where they were arguing with people. It seemed very heated. There were exclamation points. But there are insecticide ads in this part of the world now that are kind of playing with this as a way of advertising their product. Like they're killing Colorado potato beetles in the ads, which is very specific. And it's Ukrainian companies making it. So it seems like propaganda too.
Like we're pro Ukraine because we're killing the Colorado.
Yeah, exactly. And
oh, that's cool.
Everybody knows what that means, I guess, at this point. I agree with you, Mike. I think it's interesting. It's an interesting sort of quirk, I guess, that this is happening. I would be remiss if I didn't mention there's a February 2023 article, which I'll also link to. It's from an ethnologist named Deborah Jones. She points out in the article that using insects to describe one's enemies is often a precursor to war and genocide. And I know that, I guess, and I understand the contention, I guess, that she is trying to make. And I'll let other folks read it and decide for themselves, because it also talks about how Russia is using the word fascist in kind of the same way, how that is a loaded term that can be used to sort of set up the eradication of certain people. But I guess I don't 100% see the Ukrainians using the term as a prelude to Russian genocide. Do you know what I mean, Mike?
Yeah, like they're, I am in your camp, and I think what you're describing is the Ukrainians were invaded and are on the defensive. Like
right.
They're depersonifying the Russians. One, it seems legitimate because the Russians are raping and killing everybody and doing that to themselves. Like
right.
they're proving themselves to be who we think they are anyhow. But like, and you've got to do that in wartime to be able to kill your enemies, because if you don't depersonify them, like then you feel like you're killing people.
Yeah. But, I hadn't thought of that part.
But also like they're in the right, like they're morally right to defend themselves. And so doing that is not wrong. The way that doing it is wrong in the prelude to genocide.
Right. Yeah. Like calling an enemy of your people cockroaches or flies, things that we want to get rid of, I understand where this author is coming from. But similar to what Mike just said, like these people are defending themselves. It feels very trolly. It feels like a social media era version of this trope. And it needles the Russians and the Ukrainians that it's used against. Like it aggravates them. And so it seems more trolly to me than it does the prelude to genocide. But we've seen all that stuff get really twisted in recent years. So you can't say that this isn't also a possibility, I suppose, where it further down the line, it could be used for evil ends. I just really wanted to bring it up because I think it's fascinating.
Here's this North American beetle that's being used against Russia in Ukraine.
Yeah, this humble Great Plains bug is now a symbol in an entirely different part of the world of fighting against Russian imperialism. It's just kind of bonkers to think of how connected the world is nowadays. So leaving Ukraine behind, I kind of wanted to conclude by talking about some of the other ways that I became interested in Colorado potato beetle. Beyond its historical impact as a potato pest and invasive species, it's one of the star insects in the history of synthetic insecticide development. I think I mentioned this in the DDT episode, but one of the earliest sort of widely used semi-synthetic insecticides in the U.S. was Paris Green. It's a lead arsenate product. It was originally a paint, and some farmers in 1867 Illinois deduced that it could also kill Colorado potato beetles. Like that was the bug specifically that they used this sort of innovative insecticide against. And this sparked the use of Paris Green for many years against mosquitoes, hornworms, and a whole host of other pests, coddling moths and others. There were justified concerns at the time of applying lead and arsenic to food. But I actually, when I thought about it, when I was writing this, I wonder if this first success with potatoes didn't warp some people's perceptions of the safety of this product for insecticidal use. Do either of you kind of see what I'm trying to say? I guess, like, where does Colorado potato beetle feed?
Like on the leaves.
Right. And so what would we treat?
Leaves.
And then what do we eat from a potato plant?
The tuber under the ground.
Yeah. So conceivably there's no Paris green on the potato, right? Like not on the part that we're feeding on. So maybe people weren't getting exposed to the residues needed to cause poison. Cause when it's used in apples, it does poison some people later on. I'm just kind of curious if maybe that didn't help to get Paris green going in the insecticide market.
Huh.
Beyond Paris green, it also featured directly in the history of DDT. As we talked about in the DDT episodes, the first field target used for DDT was Colorado potato beetle. Paul Mueller synthesized DDT crystals based on some notes from Otmar Ziedler. He was a German chemist he was working for a German company, I should say, in Germany. And he successfully killed houseflies with the product indoors. And then Mueller, buoyed by this, took his new discovery to the field around 1940 to kill Colorado potato beetles, which I think shows it wasn't the CIA who got them to Germany, if they were already there for him to do research on. And then if you want to know what happened next, I'll link to our DDT episodes and you can get that whole story. But the short version is that the age of synthetic insecticides, this revolution, it begins really with Colorado potato beetle outside. And this is the beginning of widespread issues with insecticide resistance in Colorado potato beetle. It is a resistant superbug, currently known to be resistant to at least 56 different chemicals in 46 different regions of the world. To quote from the Insect Pests of Potato book again, quote, insecticides that have so far failed to control Colorado potato beetle are classified into 10 groups of chemicals and 8 modes of action, including the effects on the sodium channel for DDT and pyrethroids, inhibition of acetylcholinesterase for carbamates and organophosphates, blockages of chloride channels for cyclodienes, activation of GABA receptors for avermectins, agonist activity at nicotine acetylcholine receptors for neonicotinoids and spinosins, and antagonism for the same receptors for neurotoxin compounds, and finally, binding of receptors in the midgut cells by the endotoxin of Bacillus thuringiensis variety tenebrionis.
They're like super beetles.
Right? That's pretty much everything, right, Jody? Like, there's not a lot of insecticides left off that list.
So, is it like different parts of the world where these are popping up independently, or is it like one strain of beetles in eastern U.S. has all of these?
So it is noted in 46 different regions. Like, the resistance is not global, but there are multiple instances of resistance in different places of the same kind. And then they have also noted that beetles have the same adaptation. Like, if they're resistant to pyrethroids in Michigan because of this one thing, they're also resistant to neonicotinoids in Germany because of the same mechanism. So, I've got a little bit on that. So there is geographic variability and even instances where populations display resistance to multiple classes of chemistry simultaneously. This apparently reached a fever pitch in the U.S. in the 90s as potato producers in the early 90s ran out of insecticide options for controlling Colorado potato beetle. Like, there was nothing left for them to turn to. And that was sort of helped in about 1995 when the neonicotinoids were labeled for and released into the potato market. It only took about 10 or 11 years, though, for them to run those into the ground, to use them so much, so hard, that potato beetles were resistant to those too. It has shown resistance through multiple ways: reduced insecticide penetration, meaning it can't get through the exoskeleton; altered target site sensitivity, so whatever it is that we're attacking in the insect; and then metabolizing insecticides with different enzymes. We call that the insecticide resistance hat trick. That's pretty much all of it, right, Jody? Except for behavioral changes. Like, isn't that cockroaches?
Yeah, like aversion and stuff. Well, yeah. That's a lot, because you can't, like, you try to feed them something, right, and they're going to not be affected by it. Yeah, that's.
But But besides that, these other three are, that's all of them. Like, if you're going to be resistant to insecticides, you're going to do it in one of those three ways. Its status as a superbug has often been attributed to their feeding on nightshade type plants. The fear over potatoes that Europeans express comes from the fact that relatives of potatoes do have high levels of glycoalkaloids in their tissues. In order to feed on all of these solanum plants, the Colorado potato beetle would need to have evolved the ability to detoxify or at least tolerate chemicals other organisms would find poisonous. This may predispose them to be able to detoxify insecticides and even synthetic ones that we create. To put it another way, they may also already be resistant to something that we would invent here, like in the summer of 2023. And if we deployed it, the potato beetle may already be resistant to it just because of all of these detoxification mechanisms that they have.
So how do we have all these potatoes?
Well,
because if we didn't do something about them.
That's a very good question. The last thing I want to say about insecticides and them is that they also produce 2 to 3 generations a year. So there's greater reproductive chance of mutation. Individual females can lay 300 to 800 eggs. And that'll obviously be a lot of beetles potentially. And they are also genetically diverse, their offspring, because they have multiple matings. And so they can sort of pick and choose, I guess, the sperm that they're fertilizing with. To answer Jody's question, because of all of this, IPM has kind of used the Colorado potato beetle as a superstar example of why we need to do IPM. There was a quote that I read that the ability of it to cause damage and its ability to impact yield of a staple crop, as well as over 135 years of mismanagement, mean that we need to use more IPM for Colorado potato beetle. IPM tells us to use the best tools at our disposal and make sure we have a mixed toolbox. IPM is sort of born from the failures of DDT and tries to halt insecticide resistance issues. So it's easy to see how Colorado potato beetle kind of ends up as a star example. But to answer your question, Jody, on an industrial scale, there's not really any alternatives to chemical control. So it's just blasting them with insecticides. And trying to kill them and doing a lot of rotation to try and make sure that you, even if you have resistant populations, you kill them later on with a different product. They can't suffer losses. Potatoes are economically feasible, but I think it's a, kind of a thin margin, and you can lose a ton of your yield with just 10% defoliation, as I mentioned before. They do crop rotation sometimes, trying to move different things into their field for a season. Colorado potato beetle overwinters as an adult and expects to emerge into a potato field again. So if you don't have potatoes there, they don't do well. It can knock populations back by as much as 95%. But it's also hard when you're a potato farmer to switch entirely, particularly because of the money in potatoes. There may not be a feasible economic alternative. And also, if you're growing potatoes, it probably means that you can't grow other things like climatically in that area. Like think of Idaho, the king potato state in our country. I mean, that's a tough place to grow stuff. So potato may be one of their only real viable options. Does that answer your question, Jojo? There are some insecticides out there that are still labeled and work. There's abamectin, azadirachtin, chlorantraniliprole, spinosad, novaluron, cyromazin. Novaluron and cyromazin are insect growth regulators. I just wanted to throw that out there. And then spinotetrum. There are still organophosphates, pyrethroids, and neonicotinoids labeled for it, but your mileage may vary depending on if you've bred resistance into your local populations. Home potato growers do have a variety of options that start with some of that communist spirit we talked about before. Going out and picking beetles is an effective way to limit damage. Dropping the unwanted guests into buckets of soapy water is sufficient to kill them. Crop rotation also helps in the home garden, as well as the removal of alternative hosts like ground cherry or nightshade weeds like Mike has on his property. There are some more extravagant options on the market that people talk about. This is one of them I wanted to show you. This I found in a Reddit post. One of you can maybe describe what it is that we're seeing when the GIF reloads. Okay, So what are we watching here?
Oh, is it sweeping the beetles into a trough?
So
it looks like there's a person pushing, looks like bike handles and a tire. And in front of it, it looks like some kind of sweeper and like this trough, and it's the beetles. Are they getting kicked into that container?
Exactly. It's this bicycle looking thing. And then there's like a broom on the inside and it sweeps the beetle. I can't find a plan for this online. Like I've looked multiple times because it seems kind of handy, right? Like instead of hand picking, if you just have the brush, that would be something that would be interesting. There is also another method that I've read a lot about, first starting with my IPM class, and it involves the use of a propane flamer.
Oh gosh.
Potato beetle destruction. At first I thought this is crazy. I can't believe that this is a thing. It was first published by Cornell, but I will tell you, Jody, that the most commonly referenced article talking about this is the UNL Nebraska Lincoln Crop Watch article on Colorado potato beetle. To quote from it, it says, using a flamer is another mechanical method for controlling CPB. Its best fit is also in areas where trap crops are used to congregate immigrating beetles for easier control. Flaming is used on plants that are up to 8 inches tall with little adverse effects on them. Larger plants provide more protection for the beetles and effectiveness is reduced. Flaming involves using two propane-powered flame jets that are directed in an offset manner toward the row. A single unit can be bought for under $3,000 or constructed. Propane usage is usually about 3.5 to 5.5 gallons per acre. Speed is also an advantage. As might be suspected, you don't want to go too slow with this type of machine. 4 to 6 miles per hour is recommended. Control with the flamer should be done on a clear, warm day so the beetles are up on the plants. Data for early season control has been as high as 90% with this method. I think that's impressive. It's definitely mechanical control. You're mechanically destroying your pest for sure. I'm not sure that I would trust myself to walk around with propane flamethrowers in a field. What about you guys?
Yeah, Mike, I hope when you start growing your potatoes, you're not out there flaming.
Jody, I want you to know that when I read this, I was like, this is a Mike project if I have ever heard one. And I see the wheels turning in his head a little bit.
It just makes me wonder how quickly we can select beetles for flame resistance.
90% heat adaptation.
90%. There's still 10% of them that are left to
breathe. You're right. We're going to see like
chitin on these super things. Thick cuticles or something.
Yeah. I think that's a good note to kind of end on. I hope that everyone has enjoyed this deep dive into one specific insect. I truly do feel like this is history's favorite beetle. It has this weird invasive history. It popped up all of a sudden in the middle of our country. It's like, it almost feels like a biblical punishment for things that we were doing, like this peaceful beetle just eating buffalo burr. Oh yeah, no, now it's going to eat your potatoes. No more French fries for you early Americans. There are probably other beetles that have had more economic impact. There's probably more ecological impacts from things like Japanese beetle and emerald ash borer. But I just feel like the fact that it's there at the start of Paris green, at the start of DDT, that it's this resistant superbug, it's just really a unique sort of entomological star. And I hope you guys now love it too.
Thank you.
It kind of feels like potatoes. Like, they're not the star of the stew or the star of the dinner, but they're always kind of there and everybody loves them. These aren't the star of the entomological bad list, but like everybody knows what a Colorado potato beetle is.
Yep. It makes me wonder how they would taste with gravy, right?
Ew. I bet they're terrible.
I also wanted to throw out there that I know there's a lot of ongoing research involving this pest. As we need more solutions for it. If anyone out there listening is working on Colorado potato beetle, or it's been a big part of your career, I would love for you to share your thoughts on today's episode or on what you've seen with Colorado potato beetle and its history and why you've worked on it or what you've discovered. We would love to hear from you, and you can reach out to us through a variety of methods. You can find us on the web. We are arthro-pod.blogspot.com. The show is also on Twitter, arthro_podshow. And I am also on Twitter. I'm at BugmanJohn.
I'm at Jody Bugsme, UNL.
I can't believe Twitter's still around. I'm at mscavarla36.
Tweet at Elon Musk that he is a Colorado potato peel. We appreciate you listening. Let us know if you like this style of show, because we could do more in the future. Mike could pick a bug. Jody could pick a bug. Jody, you could do bed bug. You kind of did bed bugs already.
I think I've already done bed bugs.
Yeah. Would you do maybe German cockroach?
I don't know. I've got to think about this.
You'll have to.
She'd have to do an accent the whole time, though.
Yes, she would. You guys are lucky I didn't break out my French accent on here at all, like we did during Mike's stuff. I wanted to end today's show by talking about an email that we got from Emily Sewer. We all three received this. She really appreciated our podcast episode on graduate school. And she says she just got accepted into the program at Kansas State University. Go Wildcats. Enjoy.
Congratulations.
Yeah, we're all clapping for you. She also sent us a link to her store that she said, fair warning, it's a little bit on the feminist side. We'll put it in the show notes. It's a My Store link. But how would you guys describe some of the merch here? Four Girls, Two Store.
It's kind of funny.
It is kind of funny.
I mean, I'm pretty down with the mantis silhouette that says devour the patriarchy.
Yeah,
so that'll give you a pretty good feel about how that store is.
But we'll have the link in the show notes. Support a fellow entomologist, buy a cool t-shirt with a mantis that says devour the patriarchy, and show the world your true feelings. With that, we appreciate you listening. Give us a shout out if you want, and we will catch you in a couple weeks on another exciting episode of Arthropod.
It's time for our insect heroes to put away their nets and pheromone traps. Join us next time, same bug time, same bug channel, as the Arthropod gang make the world safe from poor insect podcasts. Until then,
keep on bugging.
Are you going to wash it in the creek?